Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today, the news, of course, is the White House in chaos, as they say, as the media steps up its pressure on Trump here. But I'd like you to think of the events of the past week as a part of this whole process of taming Trump that I wrote about here right after the election. Check out my blog, jackrasmus.com, for the article last November, Taming Trump. How they're going to go about doing it, and boy, they're sure going about. This is 4 weeks into the whole event since his inauguration. 4 weeks, and what a 4 weeks it's been. Quite interesting. Nothing quite like it historically. Well, what we've got here, to understand it, is not the rise of fascism. What we got is a internecine war between different wings of the elites and ruling class in this country. They're going at each other with tooth and dong. And that's what this 4 weeks represent here. They're fighting it out. The old neoliberal wing, you know, the old establishment, which is composed of dominant elements in both of the political parties, both the Democrats and the Republicans, and their base in the state, you know, not just the government. The government is what? It's the president, it's the Congress, it's the judiciary. That's the government, especially Congress and the president. But you've got this permanent institution called the state, that exists and continues regardless of changes in the government. And the state, obviously at the very core of the state, is the so-called surveillance state. We're talking about all those 17 spy agencies we've got, led by the NSA and the CIA and a bunch of others. That's the state. You know, when new governments come in, they may change the top-level folks, their appointees, but the rest of them stay. And there's this continuity, and there's this this very conservative thing called the state. And it's not just the surveillance agencies, you know, it's the other state bureaucracies, Secretary of State, and all the cabinets, and all the agencies, and all the lobbyists. You know, there's 30,000 lobbyists, registered lobbyists in Washington. 30,000. You know, this is what Trump called the swamp. Well, you know, the swamp is gobbling him up right now. And this is the continuity, and this is where the fight is really going on. The state, and the state is closely allied with the media. And the state, of course, includes the police agencies and the military and so forth. They aren't engaged yet, except on the spy side. You know, all the military agencies have their own spy organizations, all of them. That's why we got 17 so-called intelligence agencies. And they're the ones that have popped up this stuff about the dossier. Remember that the dossier? The Russians have a dossier on Trump. Of course, no one ever produced the dossier, but it was, you know, a good way to help try to change public opinion, make it look like there's too much of a close relationship between Trump and the Russians. Well, now we got this firing of Flynn. And his national security advisor for Trump, General Flynn, threw in the towel last week because they spied on him back in December and said, oh, he had conversations with the Russians. And if you're a private citizen, you're not supposed to have conversations on foreign policy. And they got him. Well, you know, it raises the real issue, and you don't hear the media talking about this much. Should these spy agencies be tapping everybody's phones? I mean, you know, they're even doing it to themselves. The ruling elite is even doing it to themselves. Everybody's being tapped. You know, there is no such thing as privacy anymore anywhere in this country. And people don't realize the scope and magnitude of all this spying going on of everybody, even each other. You know, I'm sure they've been tapping everything Trump does. They know everything he's saying to everybody. And ditto for all the rest of his appointees. And they're putting together a case. And when they have a particularly juicy piece, they use it against one or the other. And what they're trying to do is tame him and bring him around, especially on foreign policy. You see, this old state apparatus that exists that is still firmly in the hands of the old elites is being used to bring Trump around, and if he won't, they're going to sink him. And they're giving him signals here, you know. They're giving him signals. Okay, we're going to pick off one of your guys, see what we can do. If you don't play ball, you know, we'll pick off some more, and then we'll pick off you. You know, they already put impeachment proceedings in Congress, and they're already taking bets. You know, the betting agency is taking bets whether he'll resign or get impeached before the end of his first term. It was 3-1 odds, but now apparently the bettors are even odds. So it's pretty clear here that everyone knows they're going after him. And they're giving him signals. Bend to the old neoliberal policies or else. And well, so far he's still fighting back. But this Flynn affair is a good example of a warning, a shot across the bow. And there are indications that he is sort of coming around slowly on a number of items here. For example, remember he took this hard line against China, reversed the elite's long-standing One China policy and called up Taiwan and really gave the Chinese some heartburn there, and it looked like the Chinese stepped up their selling of U.S. Treasury bonds, you know, which isn't good because it drives up interest rates and makes it harder for the U.S. to make tax cuts because they can't borrow as much, et cetera, et cetera. So what did he do? Well, he reversed that quietly. You know, he called up President Xi of China and said, well, wait a minute, you know, we don't really mean that. And said, we support the One China policy, and everything cooled down with China. So, you know, that was a backtracking on China, right? Backtracking on Flynn. Watch, he's going to appoint someone reliable from the old Republican establishment now, probably somebody, you know, from the Bush administration. Well, he just did that, didn't he, with the labor secretary. He didn't get a labor secretary that he wanted, so he's appointed a busher. You know, Bush appointees are the old established elite, right? The neoliberal established elite on the Republican wing of the Corporate Party of America, i.e. the Repo Demo Party, which are very, very close on a whole number, especially economic issues, right? Okay, what else can we look to as a backtracking here? Well, his trade policy, for one. He calls Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau to his office, and oh, they're hunky-dory, hugs and kisses, and even bigger hugs and kisses for Japan's Abe Shinzo. Right? Take some golfing and the whole thing. Well, you know, this whole thing about trade means trade attacking the trade relations with some, but not all. Right? Not Canada, but Mexico, yes. Right, going after Mexico with a vengeance here. In terms of trade and demanding changes. Well, Mexico's more vulnerable. Who should he be going after? Well, whoever has the biggest trade deficit with the U.S., shouldn't it? Well, Canada's trade deficit is almost the same as Mexico, but Canada's great, right? Canada's a friend. Japan's bigger than Mexico, our trade deficit with Japan. You know, all these are like $60 to $80 billion dollars a year trade deficit, but you know, he's shaking hands with those folks. He's just going after Mexico. Well, you know, his whole electoral position of, you know, we're going to go after all these folks with trade deficits. No. He's going to go after Mexico first. Let's see how that works out. The elites do not want him to upset the world trading relationships that they have and they've established. They like the free trade. They like the multilateral free trade. Well, Trump's not against free trade. He's against multilateral free trade. He's a bilateral free trader. He's not going to overturn these free trade deals. He's going to renegotiate them and then thump his chest and say, hey, look at me. I negotiated a good deal here. I'm a great wheeler dealer real estate negotiator, right? Look at me. I'll take credit for this. That's all he's going to do on trade. If you want to listen to or watch my analysis of trade and free trade in theory and practice, there's a video presentation I gave, about an hour-long video. You can access that from my blog. It's on my website, but you can go to my blog, jackerasmus.com, on the bar, click on the website. On the website, go to the video presentations, video bar at the top. It'll take you to this hour-long video interview I did for the Henry George Society on free trade and theory and practice from Nixon to Trump. Right. Trade is a core, free trade is a core element of neoliberalism. And the old elites, want to make sure that Trump does not depart too far from this. And he's already backing up. Well, he's backing up as well on this travel ban, right? They use the courts to put an obstacle in this place on it, and then he's going to go back now. He's going to reissue here next week a new travel ban on those countries, Muslim countries. And it probably will be a much more timid affair in terms of travel ban. He'll claim it's not, but he's backing off on that as well. They've got this guy, Pence, Ford, Gerald Ford in waiting. Who's Gerald Ford? Well, when they went after Richard Nixon and impeached him, first they went after his vice president, Spiro Agnew, real piece of work and real crook. And they got rid of him first, you see, and they put Gerald Ford in, the old elite establishment figure there from the House of Representatives, as vice president, put him in before they went after Richard Nixon and impeached him. Well, Mike Pence is Ford in waiting. He's already there, right? He's the establishment piece. And when Trump fired Flynn, right, it was because allegedly Flynn lied to Mike Pence about his conversations with the Russians. Okay. The spy establishment, sometimes called the deep government, right, is leaking right and left all these image-destroying so-called no proofs, no nothing leaks about Trump himself and his support, not supporters, his appointees. Right, they're going to go after the appointees first, create a sense of chaos in the Trump government, and once they do that, see if he comes around. If he doesn't, then they'll go after him. They're building the information already, and they're creating the public opinion. You see, you got to create public opinion before you can go after someone that high. And that's what they're doing right now, creating the public opinion and laying the groundwork and shooting shots across the bow to him. And if he falls in line, that's fine. They'll let him stay there because what they really want are these tax cuts, you see, and the deregulation and the other traditional neoliberal programs. That's what they want. And as long as he delivers that, they'll tolerate him. I give him 2 years. And if he delivers on these big things, and he doesn't mess up free trade too much, and if he doesn't get too close to the Russians in the meantime, because the old neoliberal elites are neocons, too many, and many are neocons, particularly in the old State Department, and they do not want to upset what's going on in Russia. You know, the attitude of U.S. towards Russia. They want that as a crisis point, because that's how, you know, crisis with Russia, that's how they manipulate NATO and keep the Europeans in line, you see. Keep the Europeans supporting U.S. policies, economic and political, and keeping them from going too far off the reservation, creating their own economic relations and foreign policy with some of the challenges like Russia and China and so forth, right? Keeping within the U.S. orbit here is very important, and NATO is very important to that. Well, you know, Trump is railed against NATO. Why? The cost. Here's something you won't hear from the media and the press. How much does the U.S. spend on NATO? You know, Trump is saying we spend too much, the Europeans got to spend more. Hmm? How much do we spend? We spend 3.5% of our GDP. What is that? That's $700 billion a year we spend on NATO. $700 billion. Well, that's more than the official Pentagon budget. Now, part of the Pentagon budget is this part of this $700 billion. But most of the $700 billion is paid for outside the Pentagon and outside the other budgets. Okay, so $700 billion for NATO. And who else pays an equivalent amount? We pay 3.5% of GDP, $20 trillion GDP, 3.5%, $700 billion. How about the other countries? Well, the U.S. said you got to pay at least 2% your share. How many of the other European, 24 European countries pay 2%? Only three. The U.K., Poland, and little old Greece, who could hardly afford it. All the rest paid less than 2%. Some well less, less than 1% of their GDP. Well, the U.S. is subsidizing Europe. Subsidizing Europe. And Europeans like it that way. You know, they don't have to pay for defense if the U.S. pays for the defense. And the old elites, U.S. elites, like this arrangement because, you know, you control the purse strings, you control them. And that's exactly what they've been doing for years. You know, Europe is an important a part of the global picture, $14 trillion GDP. And controlling them is key. And NATO's the key. To control, ultimately, to control Europe. That's why the U.S. elites, the old line elites, do not want to upset that relationship, you know, with NATO and Europe. They're willing to spend that money to have that control. You know, one of the reasons the U.S. turned more aggressively against Russia is because the U.S. Back there a couple years ago felt that Europe was becoming too dependent economically on Russia, particularly Russian oil and gas. And the U.S. wanted to break that growing relationship between Europe and you know, Germany and Europe, reliance, dependence on Russia and gas, and growing trade between Russia and the rest of Western Europe here in a whole number of other areas. This is like, you know, 2014-15. I believe, and I wrote about it before, that the U.S. stirred the pot in Eastern Europe, particularly Ukraine, in order to create a justification for sanctions and to force sanctions on Russia and to force the Europeans to support those sanctions. Once you have the sanctions in place, you're breaking the economic ties and relationships, you see. I think that was behind, at least in part, a lot of the U.S. elites' growing opposition to Russia. And, you know, you could even argue that that was done for U.S. economic reasons, because now the U.S. is sending natural gas. As we develop our fracking here. We get all this excess natural gas, and we do these pipelines to bring the dirty oil from Canada, you know, to ports in Texas for export. Right? We don't need those Canadian pipelines for oil. We got excess of oil with all the fracking we do. You know, it's not just gas fracking; it's oil fracking. And you know, those pipelines are to export to Europe, and we're exporting now natural gas to Europe as well. The U.S. wants to be the big exporter and provider of natural gas and power to Europe. That's another source of control, and not have the Russians play that role. Well, I think this is all part of you know, what happened here 2-3 years ago, and you got to look at the Ukraine events as part of that, and you know, the fighting going on in eastern Russia, Ukraine, you know, is a consequence of the coup, its 2014 coup, in which the U.S. neocons were central and behind the whole thing, pushing it. The Europeans were willing just to have a free trade deal with Ukraine, but the U.S., for the U.S., that wasn't good enough, and in fact, the coup occurred just days before the Western Europeans were to sign a free trade deal with Ukraine. That then president of the Ukraine, forgot his name, something, well, I don't remember his name. You know, he reversed himself, and instead of a free trade deal with Russia, he said, "Okay, I'll sign this free trade deal with the Western Europeans." You know, the Troika, European Commission, Central Bank, all that, and well, that's when the U.S. pulled off the coup immediately because the U.S. wanted more. They had other ideas. The Europeans did not, at that time, want to have sanctions and pull away from Russia dependency, but the U.S. wanted them to, and the U.S. provoked, you know, the crisis there, and we know the whole story ever since, and now the U.S. is running the economy over there, Virginia Nuland from the State Department, and the CEO of Horizon Capital out of Chicago. Becomes, you know, yes, she's CEO of Horizon Capital at the same time she's in the State Department, right, as Undersecretary of State, pretty high position, Eastern Europe, a real neocon, right? She and her husband lead the one of the leaders of the U.S. neocon group here. She's in the State Department. She plays a big role in provoking the coup in the Ukraine, brags about U.S. spending $5 billion supporting all these radical street groups, you know. So anyway, now she's running the Ukraine economy. She's the economic minister. Ukraine, Petroshenko, president there, puppet Petro, what he does is change the rules. Ukrainian law allows a foreigner to become the economics minister. And that's Virginia Nuland. That's the, you know, the neocons, and that's why you got all this stuff going on in the Ukraine. Well, here comes Trump, and Trump says, "Oh, you know, we need to put this thing to bed. We need to cut a deal with the Russians here, and because this is not our real area of interest. You know, stirring all these old Cold War fights. You know, that's really not what we want to do. Well, the Cold War fights are connected to this whole idea of keeping NATO as a you know, the big carrot and stick of the U.S. to control Europe here. And even though we got to spend $700 billion a year, it's worth it to the old neoliberals and neocons to do that. Well, you know, Trump comes and he wants to upset that apple cart, you know. The problem with Trump is that he wants to change too much too fast for these old elites, and they're choking on it, right? You know, these old neoliberal policies that have been in effect since Ronald Reagan here, and both parties have supported and advanced them, you know, just too much change too soon. Well, what are some of these old policies? Well, reduce corporate costs, right? If you look at what's the huge run-up in corporate profits here, the tripling of profits since the 2008 crash, right, has not been because they're selling so much more goods, revenues. It's because of cost-cutting. In other words, it's profit margins, you know, that are the big driver of these corporate profits. Well, what cutting of what corporate costs here, since George Bush and Obama continuation? Well, wages are a big cost, cost-cutting item. You keep minimum wages from rising. You destroy the union, so there's no union wages differential. You keep free trade going, which depresses wages in export industries. You allow labor migration into the U.S. I'm not just talking about visas on 2S, unskilled coming from Latin America. I'm talking about H-1Bs and L-1s, right? We talked about that a little bit last week. 85,000 a year. By the way, this whole thing was started by Bill Clinton. He was allowing hundreds of thousands a year to come in the 90s. And now we still allow nearly 100,000 a year every year. When you come in, you can stay 6 years. And, these are skilled tech people. Most of them go to tech, you see. And, 85,000 a year, you rotate them. Some of them become citizens and so forth. You got 500,000 to 1 million people here who are foreigners on skilled foreigners on green cards. And, the tech company says, oh, we don't have any skilled people. Well, tech companies used to train people. I remember working for tech companies, AT&T, and they had really tremendous in-house training. Well, it's cheaper just to bring these people over, even the skilled, rather than train people yourself. And the government, of course, job training is a joke, has been for a long time. No government job retraining going on. We should be training our own people to take these hundreds of thousands, 500,000 minimum, million maybe jobs. And then they bring in even more people coming into the universities, you see. That's not a different visa. That's not an H-1B. And then the people, slip into citizenship from the universities, right? All this keeps wages down. Studies show that, these people coming in on software engineers and so forth, are making less than they would have to pay if they hired Americans. So, all these big companies, Oracle and Microsoft and so forth, they depend on this cheap labor. Well, that keeps wages, that keeps corporate costs down. When you privatize benefits, which has been going on since Bill Clinton, also lower costs. HMOs lowered corporate costs for health insurance, and then health savings accounts under George Bush, privatization, always an element of neoliberalism, privatization. And then Obamacare, ACA, is a form of privatization. Privatization with some rebates going on to the very poor here. Deregulation, eliminate costs, that pumps up your disposable income as a business and your profits, right? 8 years of low interest rates. Well, that reduces cost. Corporate tax cutting ever since Bush. I've said it many times, worth saying it again. We'll be writing about it on my blog, jackrasmus.com, here, because we've got this big, massive, historic corporate tax cut coming, corporate investor tax cut. That's around the corner. And how much taxes are we talking about? Well, under George W. Bush, he cut $3.4 trillion in taxes in his first term, 80% of which went to investors. And then he turns around, and at the beginning of his second term, he pushes through this boondoggle in which all these tech and bankers and pharma companies and so forth that have been parking their money offshore, talking about 2005 here, $1 trillion, he says, bring it back. Instead of paying 35%, pay 5.25%. Oh, but you got to create jobs. Okay, so they bring back $700 billion of that money. And do they create jobs with it? No. What do they do with it? They buy each other up, mergers and acquisitions, and they sit on the money, or they invest in finance, or they send it out of the country, right? Didn't create any jobs. We got that same deal going, except now it's 8-10% proposals. That's going to be part of the new Trump bill. cuts, you know, 8-10%, corporations pay 8-10% instead of 35%. Bring the money back and reinvest it. Yeah, they'll do the same thing they did before because they got away with it before and they know it. Okay, so you lower taxes, you lower interest rates, you cut regulations, you privatize benefits, you keep wages low, right? And then you keep the dollar low as well. You see, the dollar low means multinational corporations make big profits off of that. And then you change the labor markets, restructure the labor markets so that you got more part-time temp jobs, gig jobs, independent contract jobs, you know, no benefits, low pay service employment. This is what they're all bragging about, created all these jobs, you know. They're low pay jobs. At the same time, you know, we're offshoring. Free trade means you, and the tax system means you offshore the good jobs. Well, all of this reduced corporate costs. This is neoliberalism. This is what the old elite want. Well, here comes Trump, and you know, he's in some ways upsetting that. He's for deregulation, right? He's for tax cuts, but interest rates are rising, and the dollar is rising. Well, that cuts into multinational corporations' profits. He's for privatization. His policy on wages, he has no policy on wages, just let it go. So, you know, he's sort of, you know, except for low rates and low dollar, you know, he's within that neoliberal sphere here. They can deal with that. But when he says he's going to go after free trade, well, gee, that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But as I've said, he's not going after free trade. He just wants to put his own stamp on the free trade deals, bilateral free trade. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing he's not in line with, and that's promoting and subsidizing foreign direct investment by U.S. multinational corporations. Right? He doesn't want the investment to go out. He wants them to reinvest in the U.S. Well, you know, that makes them nervous. You know, it made him nervous about the free trade, but really makes him nervous here about this whole foreign direct investment, which is extremely important. Fiscal austerity, you know, that's been a part of neoliberalism, and rely on the central bank and monetary policy and low rates as the justification for reinvesting, which, of course, has been a big collapse. It hasn't worked. Low interest rates, you know, it just subsidized investors and bankers, and, in fact, has transferred money from people on fixed incomes, grandma and grandpa, right? Not earning anything, as the banks get this big tax cut through monetary policy, through the central bank. By the way, I got a new book coming out in a couple of months called Central Bankers on the Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Next Depression. Should be out by May, June. Big critique of central banking and the role they're playing and how they're contributing towards the next financial implosion that's coming here. Okay, so neoliberalism, you know, monetary policy leads and fiscal policy is de-emphasized. Well, fiscal policy in terms of spending, not fiscal policy in terms of tax cuts, you see. Well, Trump is in line with the tax cuts. You know, George Bush, as I said, $3.4 trillion, and then another $700 billion. And tax cuts for this repatriation boondoggle here. This is 2005. Then an energy tax cuts for oil companies, a couple hundred billion dollars. And then we have the crisis that hit 2008. He cuts taxes another $180 billion. Doesn't have any effect. Too little, too late. So, you know, about $4 trillion in tax cuts, mostly for investors and corporations under George Bush. When Obama comes into office, what does he do? Well, $300 billion more to try, you know, it's a stimulus program, mostly for business. And then he extends the Bush tax cuts for two more years. That's $450 billion. So that's $750 billion his first 2 years, by 2010. 2010, 2012. And then what does he do? In 2012, we get this fiscal cliff nonsense negotiations, and he extends the Bush tax cuts for another decade that costs $5 trillion. Well, you know, Bush and Obama, $10 trillion tax cuts. And what is Trump saying? 10 more trillion. $20 trillion. That's why we've got these deficits. Come on, you know, studies show that 60% of our deficits are because of tax revenue fall-offs. Low growth doesn't produce the tax revenue, and the big tax cuts at the same time. Right? So $10 trillion, and now another $10 trillion being proposed. Well, you know, Trump is in line with that, but he's not in line about fiscal infrastructure spending, you see. That kind of pushes against the whole neoliberal total reliance on monetary central bank policy. Well, that's got the elites a little nervous here. You know, his position on trade's got him a little nervous. His position here on fiscal infrastructure's got him a little nervous. Foreign policy has him really nervous, as well as domestic policy. We talked about NATO, right? NATO as a way of U.S. Subsidizing Europe, the tune of $700 billion a year. That's got them nervous. Relationships with Russia has them nervous, because if the U.S. Cuts a deal with Russia, then that's a signal that all the Western Europeans can cut a deal with Russia, too. That's the end of sanctions, and that's the beginning of growing economic ties once again between Western Europe and Russia. So, they're really nervous about that one. And that explains a lot of why they went after Flynn first here. Also, Trump appears to be on a different track as far as the old policies, neoliberal policies of promoting failed states in the Mideast. You see, the U.S. wants these failed states. If you have 2, 3, 4 failed states everywhere, then it can't. The Mideast can't unify and become a political and economic bloc long term. Right? Why does the U.S. not want unification? It wants all this chaos. Well, for two reasons: to support the Israelis, they want chaos everywhere, and the Saudis, the monarchs there in Saudi Arabia, they want chaos everywhere as well in the Middle East, because that protects them. You see, it diverts the pressure off of them and onto wherever the chaos is, be it in Syria or Libya or Iraq or wherever, you see. So it's the policy, that U.S. policy is an extension of the old British policy. Keep all of them fighting with each other, and that's how you control them, right? Trump is saying, hey, we spent $7 trillion here in these wars. That's a waste. We got nothing to show for it, absolutely nothing, what they got is what they wanted, the elites. $7 trillion is a lot of money, and $700 billion a year is a lot of money. Since the wars began in 2001, $7 trillion, that's like, $300 billion a year it's been costing us, at least, $300, $400 billion. $700 billion a year for NATO. Wow. Just those two things, keeping these wars in the Middle East and keeping NATO going, tremendous treasure that the elites are throwing out there in terms of foreign policy, throwing around in terms of foreign policy. Well, it keeps the defense establishment, military-industrial complex floated and very profitable, the whole process. Just imagine if we turned around and we spent $1 trillion a year for a whole decade on our own citizens, our own people, on the education system. You'd have free Medicare for all. You'd have free college education for all. Incredible. We'd be living an economic paradise here, if just those two sources of waste did not exist. capitalism is so wasteful, so wasteful. Another reason that Trump comes along is because the soft pivot to China. You know, Obama could not make that pivot. He's still embroiled. You know, neocons can't keep him embroiled in Eastern Europe and try to get him into a war in Syria. You know, well, you know, Hillary was willing to go along with all that stuff. That's why they loved her. But then, you know, he turns around and, you know, he tries to shake up China with this one policy, shaking up the one policy stuff. You know, the elites want to ring fence China militarily and politically. Right? At the same time, they want to open markets in China. You know, that's their whole strategy. And then he also upsets the foreign policy establishment talking about remilitarizing Japan, again, to make them pay their fair share, because we're subsidizing them too. Running a big trade deficit with them, plus subsidizing them militarily. The elites want to keep the bases in Okinawa. They don't want to have to rely on the Japanese to stay allied with the U.S. and remilitarize and have their own military bases. Who knows? You know, you can run off the reservation someday. Let's keep those bases there. You know? And let's keep the base in South Korea, too. You know, we got a big military base in South Korea, big military base in Okinawa. And then on other islands as well. So, you know, remilitarizing Japan runs against the traditional elite policies, which is Trump's policy. He going too aggressively after China initially, right? Challenging this whole failed state approach, costly in the Middle East, and then shaking up NATO, and maybe cutting a deal with Russia. Well, all of that is, you know, runs contrary to all this policy that have been building up over decades. You know, if it's just one of these things or the other, you know, they might swallow hard. But you know, it's all of them that he's taking on. The U.S. has also assumed the role that Europe has assumed, or used to assume in Africa, you know, pacifying Africa. The U.S. is there as well. And then this Iran deal. Now, the U.S. negotiated this deal with Iran and the Europeans in tow. And, you know, it looks like Trump wants to upset that as well. Well, too much chaos, too fundamental, too quick. It's got them too nervous, and they are fighting back. You know, the media has always been, the big media, big corporate media, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, they're always aligned with the old neoliberal elite, right? And they're trying to create this thing about, Trump is a fascist, Trump is a fascist, and a lot of naive people on the far left jumping up on that. Well, not the far left, you know, the middle, mild left, who don't understand what fascism is, are saying he's fascist. Well, you know, what is fascism? Fascism is when you have a social movement and the party sitting on top of that social movement destroys its opposition. In other words, it totally tames the media. The media becomes an extension of their views. The other political parties are totally neutralized, right? The unions are outlawed, and demonstrations and protesters in the street, law and order and so forth, are totally tamed. Okay? And that's those are the conditions for fascism, and that doesn't exist, you see. That doesn't, you know, U.S., you know, politicos on the left throw that term around, fascism, and they really undermine the meaning of the whole term. Are you going to authoritarian here? No doubt. That is pushing aggressively against the old policies, economic policies and foreign policies and domestic policies. You say, well, let's look at the domestic policies of Trump here. Right? Immigration. The U.S., the old elite, wants immigration. They want some, well, they certainly want the H-1Bs and so forth, right? The U.S. higher education institutions could not function at the level of profitability and expansion of management and facilities and so forth without all these foreign students coming in. That's one. And, of course, we know what's going on in the tech industry and other select industries and H-1Bs, and even the low-cost, agriculture, wants the low-cost farms, farmers coming up from Central America, keeps their costs down, and, certain industries like hotels and so forth want the low-cost labor, and small businesses, restaurants and so forth want the low-cost labor. So the U.S. wants immigration. It's always been the policy. Well, here comes this guy, and he's going to, totally cut off immigration from the South, right? That causes some problems. Mm-hmm. Identity politics, has been a way for particularly the Democratic wing of the elites to manipulate voters and manipulate elections, right? To the extent you focus everything on identity policy, you don't have to emphasize class. And if you don't emphasize class, well, then you don't have to make promises on wages and jobs and so on and so forth. The Democratic Party used to be a party of workers, and not for a long time. Right? Yeah, okay, they're allied with the union bureaucracy, the top heads, but that's not the working class. That's just an extension. Those guys are just an extension of the elites, right? They're there to pacify and keep the workers under control. Throw them a few crumbs so they look like they're doing their job, but basically keep these strikes from occurring. Keep the workers on the reservation. You see, that's what they're there for. But identity politics is a way of avoiding class politics and having to pay if you make promises when you talk about class politics, right? Privatizing entitlements, right? Slowly in stages, that's what they want. Well, is Trump going to do that? We don't know yet. Certainly, Paul Ryan in Congress is going to do that, but we don't know what his positions are on a whole number of areas on domestic policies. He's going along with deregulation and Obamacare. He's going along with deregulation and Dodd-Frank, financial deregulation. So, he's okay in that regard, but his immigration policy is causing them some heartburn. And his foreign policy in a whole number of areas is causing heartburn. And the whole idea of redirecting foreign direct investment from U.S. corporations and jobs and offshoring back to the U.S. and emphasizing fiscal spending with the infrastructure, right? All that. And then his free trade, is it bilateral or not? All of that has got them very nervous, see? And that's why they're going after him, right? And they're going after him, with a very structured approach here. They're building the real dossier on him. I'm sure they know what his taxes are, and when they want to really go after him, they'll pull those tax cuts out. I mean, his tax. They'll use that as one of the excuses. As I said in my article, Taming Trump, that's one of the main ways they'll eventually pull the coup on him. The other is conflicts of interest. They're going to make a nepotism. He just can't break with his economic empire, and that's going to be his Achilles heel here when they really go after him. But they got to, they got to build the case with popular opinion here first. That's going to take them at least a year, 18 months to do that. What you see in the last month is going to continue. And they don't want to pull the plug on him until they are able to really get the tax cuts and the deregulation and the Obamacare and the Dodd-Frank and these main things that the old elite and him are on the same track. So he's a strange bird here. He's a strange mix. Part of him being a billionaire businessman, he's right there with the mainstream Republican wing neoliberal policies. He's aligned with them, but he's not aligned with them in other ways, because he's created this new alliance, this new aggressive elites, you know, that come from the shadow banking world and you know, hedge funds and all those guys who supported him, not the traditional elites. And then he's pulled into his group here, the radical wing of the old Tea Party that was crushed by the Republican elites a few years back. You know, Chamber of Commerce and everyone got together and, you know, got rid of the Tea Partiers running on Republican tickets after they suffered some big losses. So you know, he's reunited these disaffected Tea Partiers. He's got the religious groups and the gun lobbies, right? He's got them as part of his new group here. He's got shadow bankers, big investors, speculators, you know, wheel and dealer, construction types, who aren't so concerned about foreign direct investment offshore, more about opportunities here in the U.S. And that's why, you know, infrastructure is what that's all about. Infrastructure spending is not going to be the government building roads. No, no, this is going to be deals of subsidies and tax cuts and so forth, allowing construction, commercial, industrial construction deals, where local real estate people are going to get even richer. Building going on in the U.S. is not going to look like, you know, the Public Works Administration of FDR. Mm-hmm. Okay, but that hasn't really been defined yet, but we're going to see that. But this is his new alliance, you see, and it's got a lot of these disaffected groups, including industrial workers in the Midwest, you know, who've suffered greatly from all this offshoring and foreign direct investment out and free trade, so forth. This is his new group, right? As opposed to the old elites of both parties and businesses and the media and identity politics, right? And suburban middle class independence. Mm-hmm. That's the Democratic base. You know, he's got a new base here. He's united a new base, and that's how you have to think about it. And that's why what we've got is a new wing. Here that's put together of the elites and combination of elites and non-elites, you see, and the non-elite part of it that he's got to satisfy is causing heartburn to the old elites, right? They want to keep NATO, they want to keep engaged in the Middle East. You know, they want to not piss off China for their economic investments. They want to keep, you know, Japan dependent on the U.S. as well, militarily. You know, this is the old strategy since 1940s and 50s here. And they want big tax cuts. They want that to keep going. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll let him play around with some of these domestic policies as long as he doesn't disrupt things too much. You know, you can stop in immigration, Donald, but don't touch our L1s and H1Bs and so forth. You know, that's money for us. don't touch free trade. You can dabble in bilateral free trade, but you know, don't you cut this stuff off. You know, it's too big, too much money for us. So we will see what's going on here in the future weeks here. But it's been a fascinating 4 weeks. But you must think of this as a fight, eternal fight between two wings of the ruling elite. That's what this is. This isn't fascism. This isn't some radical right-wing populism. These are, you know,